Hello and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else, a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country. I'm Elizabeth Yost-Hammer, Director of the Center for the Advancement of Teaching at Xavier University of Louisiana. And now, let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else. Hello. Today I'm speaking with Esther Hargitay. She's an Associate Professor of Communication Studies and Faculty Associate of the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. She received her PhD in Sociology from Princeton University, and she has done a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Arts and Cultural Policy Studies of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. She is currently a fellow at Harvard University. Her research focuses on social and policy implications of information technologies. And what we're particularly interested in talking about today is how IT may contribute to or alleviate social inequalities. Dr. Hargitay, thank you so much for speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
I thought what we could start out is just talk about digital inequalities and digital divide. You suggest that digital divide is no longer relevant, and I wonder if you can just tell us what that means.
Okay, sure. I should actually probably clarify. I do think digital divide is still relevant. It's just relevant to a somewhat different question. So digital divide traditionally refers to basically a binary classification of haves and have-nots when it comes to digital media, and in particular often applied to the internet. And so the idea behind this term has been that some people are online, some people are internet users, and some people are not. And this term tends to suggest that there's basically this binary approach of good and bad. And once people go online, then they've caused this divide and there's no longer a concern. And the idea here is that while that's still, it is still the case that some people fall on the side of the divide where they're not at all users, the idea behind introducing the term digital inequality, which I did in work done with Paul DiMaggio at Princeton, is that it's really a spectrum of differences even after people go online. So even once people get connected, it's wrong to think of them as all equally accessing all that the internet has to offer, because people will do so in very different ways in different contexts and with different implications for what benefits they can reap from their access and use.
So is that what you mean by inequalities then?
Yeah, so that's the idea behind this term digital inequality, is that there's really a spectrum of differences.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how did you get interested in studying this idea to begin with? What led to this, and what was some of your early research?
I started looking at the social aspects of the internet in the mid-90s when I was actually a senior in college. I had just gotten back from a year in Geneva, Switzerland, and which was interesting because the web actually had just been worked out there by Tim Berners-Lee at CERN. So this was very much the time when these things were happening. And Geneva is a very international city, and so I came back to the U.S. to finish college and was thinking about how, wow, there's the internet, the web is making it much easier to access for people, but at the same time, internationally, lots of people still didn't have access. And so I ended up writing my senior thesis in college about the international unequal access to the internet. And then when I went to graduate school, I started thinking that even within the U.S., although we had more users than many other countries, there were still considerable inequalities. So that's how I started thinking about this topic.
So you're talking about inequalities and that spectrum. I like thinking about that as a spectrum as opposed to this binary mm-hmm. way of looking at it. But what are some concrete examples? Like, what are the inequalities? What do those look like to a layperson not studying it?
Sure. So there are different dimensions on which people differ considerably when it comes to their internet uses. So one way to think about it is that even in terms of technical equipment, people will have very different types, right? Some people will have the latest gadgetry. They will have high-speed internet connection, which is very different from having a dial-up connection, which still a lot of people have, or having older machines running older software, right? A lot of things on the web nowadays require all sorts of plugins and different programs, and if you don't have them, it's much harder to access certain parts of the web. So that's one, the technical aspect. Mm-hmm. Then there's what I've called autonomy of use, and the idea there is basically the freedom to use the medium when and where one wants to. And to give two examples here that are quite big contrast, so look at a person who has 24-hour access to the internet at home, freely can do whatever she wants, versus the person who has to rely on a library connection, where the library is only open certain hours a day. One has to go to the library, then one might have to stand in line to get access to the machine, and the machine might be running filtering programs, there might be people looking over your shoulder. So even though in a really simplistic statistical manner, both of these people could be called users, clearly there's a very serious qualitative difference mm-hmm. between the level of autonomy when it comes to using that machine in your home, no filtering, 24-hour access versus a location mm-hmm. where there are others and you're dependent on hours of operation, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Then there are other domains. There's also the idea of the extent to which people in one's networks are also knowledgeable about the internet. And so let's say you have colleagues or friends who are very knowledgeable about the internet, then topics related to using the internet might come up in everyday conversations, and you might pick up all sorts of ideas on, oh, what's the latest website you should check out for something. Or if you run into a concrete problem and you need help fixing it or solving it, then if there are knowledgeable people in your networks among your friends and peers and colleagues, then you can turn to someone. If there aren't, then again, you're less able to perhaps make use of the medium in an optimal way. And then finally, a concept that I have focused on a lot in my work concerns online skill. And so the idea here is that people are going to differ considerably on the extent to which they're able to make use of the internet and how much they understand it and how much they're able to do different things.
Mm-hmm. You mean as opposed to the what you mentioned first about just having the technology, but actually knowing how to navigate?
Right, exactly. So take people and assume that they all have access, which you know a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at their skills in how they're using the internet or able to use the internet, you will still find quite a bit of variation. And one of the things that I've uncovered in my work is that this variation is not randomly distributed in the population, meaning that people's characteristics actually predict who's going to be more likely to have higher level skills.
And I'm assuming I could guess what some of those characteristics are or anticipate them, but what kind of characteristics are you thinking?
So basically what we tend to find is that a person's socioeconomic status, for example, so level of education or income predicts level of skill. So those from more privileged backgrounds tend to be better users of the internet. Have found that in some cases, women tend to be less confident in their use of the internet than men, and also find some racial and ethnic inequalities as well.
It just kind of came to my mind as I was hearing you speak about this. Do you think new technologies like the iPhone, I'm thinking like iPhones and Blackberries and those kind of, you know, now the portable internet, do you think that the popularity of some of those kind of things are going to help with these inequities or make them even more exaggerated?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think it could go in different directions. Certainly for now, I don't think it's going to get rid of the inequalities, partly because these devices themselves are expensive enough, and even if the devices themselves are not that expensive, certainly the data plans are. Mm-hmm. So for people who are from less privileged backgrounds, while they're very likely to have a phone plan, they're less likely to have a data plan. And so if you look at who uses their cell phone for email and web surfing, that's still not equally distributed across the population. Now, over time, that might change, although given the current economic situation, I don't know if it's about to change very quickly. And again, even with mobile devices, there are skills involved. There are different applications one can use, right? So I have a very smartphone, Nokia N95, which I can download all sorts of applications to, but I need to know how to do that, and I need to know where to find the applications. Mm-hmm. So, for example, my phone runs a program that basically makes my phone into a pedometer, which counts steps as I walk, which is helpful. But again, I needed to find out that that was an option. I needed to find where I could get that program. I needed to download it. So even though it's free, there's still some skill involved in being able to get it and install it.
Mm-hmm. And I think even understand what an application can be on your phone.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
But before we move on from these categories that you mentioned, though, my background is in psychology. So the one I find the most fascinating is that whole autonomy of use idea. I think that's really, you know, that's a really fun, kind of fascinating one, because I think that's got psychological implications. And I was wondering, on NPR this morning coming to school, I just heard this report. I don't know if you heard it, but it was a reporter talking about in response to the stimulus package and that part of the money is going to go to broadband and rural communities and helping, you know, rural communities you know, get online and get on the internet, and that should help with jobs and this sort of thing. Did you hear that at all?
I did not hear the NPR report, but interestingly, I was just reading the stimulus bill, looking for the sections that address broadband.
Huh.
And I have right in front of me section 6001, which Part B, which refers to things like provide broadband education, awareness, training, access equipment, and support. So this is actually very much in the bill, that recognizing that this isn't really just a technical issue.
Mm-hmm.
And back in December, I had the opportunity to go talk to some people on the transition team. And we pretty much had a discussion about this issue. And they seemed very interested.
I'm certainly not asking us to get political here, but what does your research suggest? I mean, that this is an important thing to do? Because, of course, on the NPR report, they were doing both sides, and there was, you know, one person said that's the price that people pay in rural communities, and it's not an effective green way to live. And so what does your research suggest?
I'm not sure what you're asking exactly about.
I'm sorry. Not a clear question. I mean, I'm trying to think of a way to ask it, not as a political question, but as a research question. Does your research that you've done suggest that education and accessibility for all people, regardless of SES and regardless of education levels, it would be a beneficial outcome?
So the research is very much in the beginning stages in terms of long-term outcomes, so it's really hard to say. And partly, I don't have a problem getting somewhat political here. The last 5 years, there has been very little data collected nationally on internet users. So basically, 2003 was the last time that the current population survey collected information about internet uses. And the last report that came out from the National Telecommunication Information Administration was called A Nation Online, and seemed to suggest that we had solved the problem of inequities, even though the four reports before that one were called Falling Through the Net. Mm-hmm. And if you looked at the statistics, it was certainly not the case that suddenly everyone was online. It was, you could really see a rhetorical shift.
Mm-hmm.
And then for 4 years, we had absolutely no data being collected on this, so we couldn't really track it. I mean, there've been other types of data collection going on. The Pew Internet and American Life Project collects helpful data. as do some other entities out there, but nothing like the current population survey, which is through the Census Bureau. Mm-hmm. And then in 2007, they had another supplement that some of us were very enthusiastic about, but then saw what it was, and it was basically just a few questions asking pretty much no more than, do you use the internet? Which is not something that allows us to answer these questions of what are the actual beneficial outcomes and who's benefiting and how exactly. So one of my hopes is that we will again see better data collection in this realm so we can answer some of these very important questions. Mm-hmm. But for sure, rural areas have been disadvantaged. And in this country, we have for a long time had all sorts of subsidies, right, even in terms of the postal system, to make sure that rural areas are not left behind. So mm-hmm. I think an argument can definitely be made that there should be some subsidies to make sure that people there can also access mm-hmm. the internet.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this is that leads me to the real question I want to ask, and then I'd like to shift and talk a little bit about implications of this for education. But, you know, so what are, you know, of the work you've done, the research you've done, and that you're currently doing, I mean, what's the so what question? Why should we worry about these inequities? And, you know, what are the implications of these inequities? You know, what do you see as implications there?
Sure. So the concern is that, as I said, it's not random as to who uses the internet well and who doesn't. And also, I guess what I haven't said yet is that I've also looked at, for example, the different types of things people do online. And this, again, isn't random. So people who are in more privileged positions tend to use the internet for more things. And mm-hmm. one could argue that the more things you use it for, the better potential outcomes of it, right? So there are very, again, very qualitative differences in how one can use the internet. One could just check sports scores all the time, mm-hmm. or one could do all sorts of things from checking sports scores to learning new skills that might be relevant for jobs, to understanding finance better, to reading up on health issues. I mean, there are lots and lots of very potentially beneficial uses. And it's not enough to say, oh, well, if people are not motivated to do that, you can't make them, because a lot of people just don't understand what's out there. And there's so much material out there, and there's also so much incorrect material out there that it definitely requires some amount of education for people to be able to make sense of it, or for everyone to be able to make sense of it and to locate the right sources, to locate the most relevant sources.
Mm-hmm.
To find the tools that are of interest. And so for this, I think it is absolutely essential that we have education, awareness, training as part of the deployment of the technology, because it's not simply a technological problem, and so you can't just fix it with a technical solution.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the so what, I mean, the problem is that from the data that we do have, it seems like people who are already in more privileged positions are the ones who are more likely to use it for more things. And so the potential there is those who are less privileged might fall behind even more. And that's really not what we want to see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the education part, so I'm going to kind of go with that for a minute. What do you, and I know that this is not your research area per se, or really what you're doing this work for, but as you think about this, how can this, or how do you think this digital inequities are affecting college classrooms, or can affect college classrooms, whether it's students or teachers or?
Sure. I mean, again, people in college, even though you're controlling for a level of education at some level, they still come from very different backgrounds. And so you would want to make sure that people are on a similar page, and those who come from more privileged high schools or more privileged families don't sort of run away and leave the others behind in terms of their online skills and abilities. So a lot of college classes now require all sorts of searching for information. I mean, that's always been the case. Mm-hmm. It's just that a lot of this has moved to the web. And so you want to make sure that students know how to access good information, how to make sense of it, how to understand it, how to find the right tools. And then some would argue even the idea of everyone having opportunities to make their own voices heard, right? So one of the enthusiastic, encouraging aspects of the web, especially in more recent years, is this participatory aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what we find is that it's not equally distributed, that certain people are more likely to be posting their own content, and that way certain people are going to be more likely to influence conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, for that purpose, you want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to be part of those conversations.
And by there, I'm assuming you mean like blogs or...
Sure, I mean anything from
yeah.
posting a video to putting it to having your own blog, to posting your own writing, to commenting, to voting on content that's out there, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell me what do you teach and how has this this knowledge that you have about the research and about, you know, the area that you study, has it influenced your teaching or your interaction with students?
It certainly influences it in the sense that I am very conscious of the fact that they aren't all super savvy, per se, when it comes to the internet. So I think a lot of instructors might go into the classroom thinking that all of the students know a lot about IT and sort of take that for granted, and I think that's problematic because they don't. And the class I tend to teach to undergrads, the classes have to do with the internet, so it fits very directly,
yeah.
right? So if you have an internet and society class, then I can very organically fit in somewhat skills-related things. But even when it's not specifically the topic of the day, I will often take a few moments to show them tricks and tips. And I think some of it you can do it as part of, say, you know, if they're working on writing a paper, then I'll take some time to show them things like Google Scholar or but also just how you read, for example, domain names and things like that, and how do you search more specifically, and things that they don't actually necessarily know. And so it's worth taking the time
mm-hmm.
to explain.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like I felt like it's just a stereotype. It's another type of stereotype that we tend to have about students. Oh, they know all this.
It is a stereotype, and it's actually, to me, it's interesting because those who teach in the classroom and interact with 18, 19-year-olds should know better because, I mean, I think they kind of give away their ignorance on occasion pretty explicitly mm-hmm. if you're paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it might require instructors to pay careful attention to that, right? And again, not walk in there with this assumption that
mm-hmm.
they know everything.
Mm-hmm.
They know a few things extremely well, right? Like certain things they use a lot.
Text. They know how to text.
They know how to text. They spend a lot of them spend a lot of time on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
Yes, but a lot of other things they don't know that could be absolutely beneficial for them.
Uh-huh. Well, and probably that have those critical thinking skills components behind them in terms of evaluating the content.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's making me think of the recent articles on digital natives, and is this, you know, are there really digital natives? And have you in your work, I mean, does your work kind of counter that idea that students are digital natives and faculty are not, and we're in different areas here?
I mean, I think in some dimensions there is some difference, right? I do think it's a little complicated as to where you actually draw the line.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain areas where it is different to grow up with it from the start, but I think this often gets translated because maybe even because of the semantics of it, right? Digital native, as opposed to say immigrant, which I don't really like those terms, because the native does seem to imply that they know it,
mm-hmm.
and while I think there are different ways in which they might relate to the technologies because it's sort of taken for granted that it's part of everyday life and most interactions, that doesn't mean they get it all, right? And so it's important to recognize that,
mm-hmm.
that there are different ways in which it might matter that they have grown up with it more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, there are older people who are extremely fluent with the technology.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's required to have grown up with it.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost another stereotype there.
It is another stereotype,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, before as we wrap up, I've got one more question, but I wonder if there's any last like any tips or advice you would want to give faculty members who are listening to this podcast who might just be interested in being sensitive to this issue in their classrooms? Do you have any tips or advice you might want to offer?
Again, I wouldn't walk into the classroom assuming that all students know everything. I think also teachers actually do often know things that most students don't know about. I think it's worth being explicit about these things and having discussions about them instead of assuming away either in either direction, actually. But also that teachers can approach it in a way that they're curious to hear the perspective of the students, right? And by getting the perspectives of the students, for example, having a discussion of what are their favorite tools or websites, teachers could learn, but also that way realize that, well, what is it that the students know and what are the areas where they might be lacking? But basically that basic assumption, I think instructors need to shed that if they have it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. My last question I have for you, and this is, again, broadening back out from the classroom, but I just think about your work in general and it having, you know, societal implications and political implications and educational implications, and, you know, it really is just a part of this, you know, this modern life. And I wonder if you can think of any other phenomenon that's happened historically that you could compare to this, that we could compare to the internet. Can you think of other historical tools or techniques that kind of came along that has shifted our paradigm as much as this?
I mean, I think historically there probably are all sorts of tools that have shifted paradigms in various ways, whether it's other communication media or other, for example, industrial, innovations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anything, you know, for example, automobiles had a very significant influence longer term on urban life and suburban life. And so I think there are all sorts, depending on how one looks at it. Again, even if we just keep it within the realm of communication media, it's interesting what kinds of shifts we saw. I mean, I think what's important to think about is not to assume that the technology will have any one particular type of effect, that to understand that technologies enable all sorts of things, but then it's often up to social factors, whether it's government or businesses or the users, to shape what comes of those technologies and how we tend to adopt them and how they end up influencing different things. So depending on these factors, their effects could go in all sorts of different directions.
Well, Dr. Horatai, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I think your work is very interesting, and I wish you luck on all the rest of your data collection.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else. For more information, please visit our website at cat.xula.edu. That's cat.xula.edu. Until next time, this is Elizabeth Yost-Hammer.